Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. PGA Tour is back in the mainland. Start of the American Express. In my opinion, we are now entering the best stretch of the entire PGA Tour season. Palm Springs, Torrey Pines, Pebble Beach, Phoenix, Riviera. But first, Rex, there's plenty to get to from the week that was, including this note on Twitter from Twitter user Jason Grant, who said, Rex, can y'all skip the useless chat at the beginning of each pod, please? Otherwise, the episodes are a really good listen. Rex, in that spirit, what's on your mind today?
More useless chat. Is that what we're going to lean into? I'm going to start, Jason. I'm going to start very serious. This is not useless chat. Monday morning, I woke up. We're taping this on Tuesday morning. Monday morning, I woke up, turned on ESPN, started catching up, and became irrationally angry at what I was hearing on TV. And jealous, just filled with rage and jealousy, because those people can sit on TV and they can scream and yell at the top of their lungs because the Cowboys lost, and then last night the Eagles lost, and they can demand people lose their jobs, and they can talk about how bad they were at their jobs, and we don't ever get any of that. We never get the opportunity to sit in front of this camera and be like, yep, he should be gone, out of here. How do you do your thing? Zip. Is that how you do? We never get that opportunity. And I'm just filled with rage and jealousy because we live in a sport that's far too Gentile, I'm going to say. Like, we don't, like, even the one person over the
placid
last two. Yeah. The one person over the last 2 years that we could probably talk about maybe should or should not lose his job is Jay Monahan. Even on that front, I probably come in a little bit too soft because I have said, I don't know if he should lose his job. Like, I don't pretend to know, you know, if he did a good job or a bad job the last 2.5 years. Like, I'm not qualified to make that assessment. And yet Stephen A. Smith and everyone else on ESPN can sit in front of those cameras and scream for hours for people to lose their jobs. And it just makes me so irrationally angry.
That doesn't necessarily make me angry. I think it makes me envious that we're not in a sport that's more conducive or prone to spirited sports talk. I mean, the greatest controversy that we had from the past week was Carl Yuan receiving TOI relief on the 72nd hole of the tournament. It ended up losing the likes of JT Poston, probably $40,000. Carl Yuan banked an extra $100,000 because he was granted free relief, made par when he probably would have dropped at least one shot had he had to replay the shot from the bunker. We're not even going to get into that in this pod. It's not even worthy of a pod discussion, but that's basically the extent of controversy.
That's it. What are we going to sit here and yell about? I mean, Grayson Murray winning? Like, I'm not yelling about that. I got plenty of opinions on it. But I never, even when, I think we had this conversation, when the USGA and the RNA last month announced the rollback, which maybe it's because we knew it was coming and we talked about it for, it seemed like, a decade. But even on that day, when I felt like I probably could have manufactured some rage or some, at least some outrage, and because I had an opinion on it, even that I had a hard time getting really, really worked up. I'm kind of like, well, we known this is coming. They had to do something, it feels like. They weren't going to be persuaded to not do anything at all. That doesn't seem like it was an option. Instead of being able to sit in front of a camera and be like, oh, yeah, that's terrible. He has to lose his job. Even at the Ryder Cup, when there was legitimate things for us to get worked up about and scream about, we still were kind of like, well, I mean, it's fun. It's entertaining. I just kind of want to sit here and watch do the popcorn thing.
I mean, we'll have spirited debate.
Sure.
On this podcast, but it's about the lamest topics. I mean, let's be honest. You know, like, just in this past week alone, you know, the director of golf from the Grove 23 MJ's course in South Florida, he got a sponsor exemption into the Dubai Invitational. People were freaking out. I think he finished 72 shots behind Tommy Fleetwood, which is actually kind of like ugly and yet beautiful symmetry all at the same time. It's like, who cares? It's one of two sponsor exemptions. It was clearly almost like a silly season kickoff event for the DP World Tour in 2024. I just have a hard time mustering any sort of outrage. That's not to say we won't have spirited, passionate debate, especially when we get towards major season, but I'm with you. I'm kind of envious of the sports debate and the sports talk that's going to be certainly dominating the airwaves for the next week. Rex, that actually... So Jason, I just want you to know, I hear you, I feel you. In all seriousness, we probably will be a little bit more cognizant moving forward. If this is a golf podcast, you folks are really interested in listening to golf, so at least try to delay our random musings until later in the pod. Rex, a little bit of news from the past week. The announced departures last week of both RNA head Martin Slummers and DP World Tour Chief Executive Keith Pelly. Slummers will be done by the end of the year. Pelly has said that he wants to stay on until the beginning of April, hoping to stay on for three more months, presumably to get this Tour PIF deal across the finish line. In your opinion, which departure is the most significant?
I think Keith leaving has sort of been in the cards a long time. I actually called a European Tour player who I talked to a lot about this the day it happened. And I think no one falls up better than Keith Pelly, which was a very backhanded comment. I don't know that I particularly agree with it, but there had been talk all along that he wanted to move on. Specifically, he wanted to move on to the NHL. He wanted Bettman's job. He wanted to be the commissioner there. This is probably the next best thing because he'll be in Toronto. I think he's going to be working with a group that owns the Maple Leafs and a lot of other sports franchises. He's from Canada. It makes perfect sense. I think the only, and this is where I am going to manufacture that outrage. I think the one thing that got me sideways about this is everyone's more than, you know, free to go and pursue whatever your dreams are. If you have a bucket list job, by all means, man, go after it, enjoy yourself. In this particular case, I don't know that he's going to see the job through. That's my problem. I know he said he feels like they can get something done before April 2nd. And I feel like there is movement on the front between the PGA Tour and Saudi Arabia's public investment fund. But by all accounts, it's very, very slow movement. That unless something breaks real quickly over the next few weeks, if not months, then this is going to be a long drawn out process. We knew it was going to be a long drawn out process. I don't know if anyone other than Keith is going to be racing towards their April 2nd deadline, to be quite frank with you. So in this particular case, I was a little surprised that he would do it because you want to stay, you want to get the job done. I just joked about Jay Monahan. It seems like he is determined for all the right reasons to stay and make sure the job gets done. So that one didn't surprise me, but I am a little confused because as a chief executive at a very pivotal time in this industry, it seems like a bad time to walk away, to take
arguably the most critical point in men's elite professional history, right? Like we're talking at a foundational shift that we are about to undertake, and he's pulling the ripcord on April 2nd with Guy Kinnings, a longtime top lieutenant of the DP World Tour.
And big fan of Guy. I think Guy's going to do a phenomenal job.
He's obviously well equipped and well versed in exactly what they're dealing with. But obviously, the timing could not be worse for Keith Pelly to land his dream job and then leave at this time. For Martin Slummers, like, this is going to be the end of his ninth year at the RNA. That's almost always kind of the back end of the tenure that RNA head would have. When you look at what he accomplished, you know, getting the golf ball roll back across the line just a couple of months ago, he opened up several commercial opportunities of the Open Championship and making that more profitable the year's final major. I also think he did a pretty deft job, Rex, of kind of navigating the tricky terrain that is this PIF investment. You know, he hasn't been as forcefully against the thought of Saudi backing as like a Masters chairman Fred Ridley has been, has kind of kept an open mind towards it. I think that remains to be seen what that's going to look like in the future. But I thought he's kind of definitely navigated that as well. I think Keith Pelly's legacy, though, Rex, will be a little bit more mixed. What's your opinion on how he will be remembered? Let's just live in a fanciful world where this thing gets done by April 2nd and he can go do his dream job back in Toronto and live a great rest of his life. Let's say that gets done. What do you think his legacy is going to be remembered for?
If we're in a dream world and this somehow gets closed and we have some sort of combination of this new entity that includes the PGA Tour, DP World Tour, and LIV Golf, essentially is what it's going to be. I think that would probably long-term be the legacy. At least that's going to be the lead of that story that's going to be written about his time as the chief executive of the European circuit. I will say up to that point, there are plenty of things you can point at. Like I'll give Keith a monsoon of credit, whatever he's done with the strategic alliance with the PGA Tour. And there's plenty of people on both sides who don't like it, but I think it was his only option. Like, I think he had to make a deft move and that was it. He needed to make sure that they were not only in the game for the long term, but they were part of the solution, not part of the problem. And he moved. You can like it, not like it, that the DP World Tour essentially became a feeder system for the PGA Tour. But what he did is create a pathway for the top 10 players to play their way onto the PGA Tour. I think if you look, dig a little bit deeper, I'd love some of the initiatives that he's had over his tenure as chief executive over there. You look at some of the events that they've introduced with shot clocks and some of the things that they've done to be a little bit more creative. And certainly the way they continue to expand their tour globally, whereas the PGA Tour can sort of seems like it was always shrinking, becoming more and more American-centric. DP World Tour just kept branching out. I think all of those things will be pointed to as part of his legacy. But the biggest one, of course, would be any kind of agreement between them and the PIF and the PGA Tour.
I think it's going to be mixed. I think it's going to be complicated. I think it's going to be nuanced. He was certainly lauded for his leadership during the COVID pandemic and getting golf tournaments on the schedule with reduced purses, but still being open for business that summer when so many other sports were shutting down. The reason I say complicated and mixed is because he did have an option. Keith Pelley did entertain the Saudis' financial backing for the circuit and ultimately decided against it. Now, who knows how that could have turned out, right? If the PIF had all of a sudden started pumping millions, if not billions of dollars into the European tour, you know, would that be the preeminent golf circuit as we sit here on January 16th, 2024? Who knows? I think what we do know for sure is that the DP World Tour did strengthen its alliance with the PGA Tour. It did alienate some longtime European stalwarts, whether it's Lee Westwood, Sergio Garcia, Ian Poulter. And I think it's indisputable that they've effectively rendered the old European Tour, as you said, a feeder system with the top 10 players now getting PGA Tour membership. They can put a PR spin on this however they want, but each and every year, the 10 best performers on the European Tour are being promoted to the PGA Tour. That is the definition of a feeder system. If Keith Pelley can help get this deal across the line, if we can develop some sort of world circuit where, you know, the elite PGA Tour players are playing a schedule that's predominantly in America, but you're borrowing some of these national opens or some of the marquee events on the DP World Tour, I think everyone wins. And I agree with you. I think that's going to be a large part of his eventual legacy as well, if he can get across the line.
And I will say this, I mean, along with Jay Monahan, I'm not quite sure. And again, this goes back to him getting fired, him not getting fired, either one of them. I don't know that anybody was equipped for what happened in golf really in the world over the last 5 to 6 years, where you pointed out the pandemic. And I've gone a step further when it came to Jay Monahan, that essentially during his tenure as commissioner, he lost Tiger Woods as a regular competitor. I think I did the math. Since Jay Monahan has been commissioner, Tiger Woods has played 14 regular season events. So essentially, Tiger retired during his tenure. And then you factor in what became the PIF and LIV Golf and the quote-unquote irrational threat. I'm not quite sure anybody was prepared for that. So looking back, you're right. I love when you mentioned that the other side of it, it's the Malta meeting, right? It sounds so sinister, and it sounds like it's the start of a really, really good movie. And it really wasn't, it turns out, because we don't know what the conversation exactly was there, but whatever the offer the PIF was making to the European Tour, they clearly got a better deal from the PGA Tour. Maybe time and more daylight, and we understand exactly what was on the table from both sides, will change that opinion. But I think he did a very good job, or at least a good job as commissioner.
Yeah, I think at that time, Keith Pelley wanted to be, as Rory McIlroy once said, on the right side of history. But now, as we have seen over the past 2 years,
funny how that changes. The
sport is certainly changing. Rex, let's keep it on the DP World Tour for a minute. The Dubai Invitational. Rory McIlroy and Tommy Fleetwood were the headliners for this one. I found myself oddly enraptured by what was unfolding at like 6:30 a.m., on Sunday. I'm up, of course, because Cam refuses to sleep in on the weekend. And Rory McIlroy looked like he had it in the bag, and then he didn't. And he looked like he had it in the bag once more, and then blew it on the 72nd hole. If you guys missed it, Rory was leading by a single shot on the tee of the 18th hole and rope hooked his tee shot into the water, made bogey, and Tommy Fleetwood poured in a 15-foot birdie putt to win the golf tournament, his seventh on the DP World Tour. So what do you take away more from what was kind of a silly season event. 60 pro, 60 amateurs. As we mentioned, the director of golf at MJ's course in South Florida, finishing a whopping 72 shots behind Eddie Pepperell, calling him basically Ken from Barbie. Does not care if Ken from Barbie is in the field. He does not want a player of Ken Wyand's caliber in the field. What'd you take away? Roy's loss, Fleetwood's win. What was the headline for you?
Well, you called it a silly season event, and I think Eamon Lynch called it something similar on Golf Today when we did the roundtable yesterday. And I'm drawn to the idea that 60 players, 60 amateurs is essentially what we're going to have at Pebble Beach in a few weeks, and that's a signature event. So I'm not quite sure how we're going to reconcile those two different opinions. Probably the quality of the field wasn't what you would expect it to be. And I think it's twofold. One, from Rory's perspective, he has a really good history. Like, at this point, we know who and what Rory McIlroy is, and he's really good showing up beginning of the year after taking a couple weeks off and being pretty good. Like, he has found a way to not start slow, which a lot of players would in that situation. In this particular case, there was rust, and you talked about the missed drive on the 72nd hole. That's not Rory. Like, when Rory's playing his best, he doesn't miss that drive. You talk about the three putt from essentially 3 feet, I think, on the 14th hole on Sunday. Again, that's just a mistake that I don't think he makes mid-season form. I actually went kind of the other way, though. I like what this could possibly do for Tommy Fleetwood. Even if this was, I don't know what you want to call it, a secondary event, a silly season event, whatever the case may be, you still beat Rory McIlroy on a Sunday to win a trophy. And that does something for you. And when it comes to Tommy Fleetwood, and you looked at sort of the arc of his career over the last few years, I think this could be a boost for him coming into this season. Not saying it's going to translate into wins in the United States or major championship wins, but it certainly shows that he's on the right path.
The only difference between the Dubai Invitational and the AT&T Pebble Beach National Pro-Am is about $18 million.
No, that's not fair. And Pebble Beach, to be fair.
That's the main difference as well. I was definitely struck by Rory's demeanor and how he acted during what became a final round loss. Rory almost always shows up sharp for his first event of the new year. He's the defending champion this week at the Dubai Desert Classic. His record in what is typically his first event or either Abu Dhabi is outstanding. Like, he always comes ready to play, and yet he seemed to have this built-in excuse of, you know, it's going to be sloppy. I'm staying on site this week because I want to knock some rust off my game and get my game sharp for the rest of the season. Like, he didn't have the past 2 months to be, you know, saddled with 9 or 10 hour board meetings. Like, this was supposed to be the new Rory in 2024, where he's hungry, he's focused, he's not distracted by all this off course stuff. And yet he seemed to have this built in excuse already. Like, he was plenty sharp. Like, he finished top 10 in every major statistical category for this tournament. And yet some of his mistakes, I thought, were really sloppy. Some were physical, obviously, like the hook into the water on 18, but some of them were mental as well, just kind of pure lapses of concentration, whether it was hitting an iron into the water on the front nine on Sunday. He made a quad in the second round, actually did well to rally just to take the halfway lead, and obviously the three putt from either 2 or 3 feet on the 14th hole. Those were just kind of all curious, and it added up to a bizarre scene, which kind of speaks to the stature of the event, where he's fist bumping Tommy Fleetwood, he's hugging Tommy Fleetwood, he's walking off the 18th green as gracious as could possibly be after losing the golf tournament with his arms slung around Tommy Fleetwood. I get that they're friends, but it was a very strange reaction to losing the golf tournament over the past year. Again, this is not the Masters. This is not a major championship. I get that they're friends, but didn't it all seem just slightly strange just how noble, just how gracious Rory was being after losing the golf tournament?
You guys had that conversation yesterday on Golf Today. I didn't take it that way, only because he and Tommy are so close. I mean, we named him Fleetwood Mac at the Ryder Cup. Like, these two are essentially...
Rory's got a lot of friends on tour. That doesn't mean his arms slung over their shoulder walking off the
green. He does, but I've never really seen, outside of the... excuse me, that's a fine. Outside of him ripping his shirt off, I think that was in Dubai as well. Again, comically, one of the best scenes I can ever imagine in my mind, because we didn't actually get the physical ripping of the Hulk shirt off, but I can only imagine how he struggled with it and he couldn't quite get it. Outside of that particular episode, I don't really remember him ever, like, sulking away.
No, he's always I would call him a good loser, at least in public, right? Like he's well, I guess the Patrick Cantlay Ryder Cup would probably be a different example.
That's another one too. There's a rage monster in there somewhere apparently that comes
Rory's up. On course behavior. But typically, like in a post round press conference, like he's typically complimentary of us playing competitors, and you know he wishes them well and says all the right things. I was just struck that 15 minutes earlier, he doomed his chance to win a golf tournament, and yet he was smiling and seemingly happy about it, and easy to kind of chalk this away to simply some rusty mistakes.
I guess to your point, what do they call it? Someone who's a good loser? Again, they're a good
bad winner.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm going to go ahead and just say at this stage in Rory's career, I don't know why he would get worked up over that particular event. Like, look, everybody wants to win. And I know in the heat of the moment, it's easy to get carried away. At this stage in his career, he knows the events that matter and he knows where his game needs to be. Not now. I don't think he's worried about the second week of January, exactly the state of his game. It's going to be that first week of April that he's worried about the state of his game at that point. And you could say the same thing about the other major championships this year. So no, I didn't read too much into that. I guess I get your point. When you look, I mean, you counterbalance that to what happened at the Sony Open. And I would ask you, like, the reaction that you saw from Ben On, from Keegan Bradley, that to me was the opposite end of that. Those two guys were gutted about that finish, the playoff, not being able to get it done, the way everything sort of flipped there on that first playoff hole. So I guess I get where you're coming from. But in Rory's mind, you said it. I mean, this felt like a silly season event.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, obviously he had probably 10 to 15 minutes to process what was happening. Rory McIlroy did after hitting the tee shot in the water. He probably figured that was his opportunity that was lost, while Ben On like literally missed a four footer, didn't hit the hole, and was processing that in real time as he was walking off the green. I think maybe I'm just projecting. I think all of us want Rory to kind of recapture the old swagger, the old hunger, the alpha of his 24, 25 year old days, when he's just a dramatically different person and player at age 34 than he was then. I think that could be it. And I think 2024 is setting up to be a hugely significant moment for Rory's career. Now, a decade without a major championship. Again, he does not have the distractions that have been kind of dogging him for the past 2 years. Like, this is his opportunity to seize it and still some of the best form of his career and really capitalize on it. And this just seemed like an opportunity squandered. As it relates to Tommy Fleetwood, at least, Rex, like, I actually think this was somewhat meaningful for him. You look at his PGA Tour statistics from 2023, like, that was the best season he's ever had. No, he did not win, and he has continued to not win on the PGA Tour. But overall, worldwide, he had 10 top 10s last season. He's up to 11th in the world ranking now, just one off his career high. He has plenty of major championship experience, you know, in the year's final major, the Open Championship at Royal Liverpool. He was going head-to-head with Brian Harman there, and we know how that all turned out, but he's given himself plenty of opportunities. Now, I think we kind of know who Tommy Fleetwood is at this point, a player who is kind of going to live between 10th and 20th in the world ranking. He's going to pick up a couple of wins over a period of time, maybe not win as much as we think a flusher like him should, but I really do think that beating Rory head-to-head, even if it is just kind of a silly season event, I think that could be a huge confidence booster and perhaps now sets him up to get his first multi-win season since 2017.
10 to 20 in the world. That's a good spot to be.
Yeah. It's very comfy. Yeah. The expectations are not overly high. And yet, you know, you're in everything. You're going to give yourself plenty of chances to win and make a boatload of money.
I argue all the time that the best job in the NFL is the backup quarterback job. Because you get paid a lot of money, you get to hold the clipboard, you get to have the headphones on, and very rarely are there any expectations.
A lot of prep work, though, to be a backup.
Sure. You're watching a lot of film. I would argue that probably that 10 to 20 in the world is probably a pretty good place to land as well. Because you're making a lot of money, but the expectations aren't through the roof. Where you're not getting, like, this conversation is a perfect example.
30 to 50 is the sweet spot. You're probably not getting the featured groups.
Instead, how disappointed you are in Rory, and he didn't show the fight. Maybe he's too nice, or whatever else you were trying to say. But for Tommy, it was, oh yeah, Tommy was great. Well, I think that's the difference in the expectations. If you're 1 to 5, man, if you don't win in that situation, then poof, something's wrong with you. But if you're in that, maybe, yeah, you're probably right. Like, I'm going to say 25 to 50. If you're 25 to 50 and you're going head to head with Rory on Sunday in Dubai and you lose by one, everyone's like, ah, good job. You did well. Well,
I always joke with my wife that like the best job in pro golf was being a former Georgia Bulldog, because you could lump them all in a very similar category, whether, you know, a couple of years ago, whether it was Chris Kirk, Brian Harman, Hudson Swafford, Harris English, like they were all good enough to not even come close to losing their PGA Tour cards. They would always at least challenge for a win, if not win. They'd make $2-3 million, and yet they could go to Publix, probably not get recognized, and just live a very happy, peaceful life, playing in major championships and just living a very blissful existence. Now I think, you know, times have changed a little bit, but it probably still is that 25 to 50 window.
I think that would be a brilliant feature to do for Live From, where you go to Athens with Brian Harman and you guys just go into the different grocery stores, whatever the case may be, the Chick-fil-A, just walk through, go to the Waffle House for breakfast and see how many people actually recognize him.
In Athens, they would definitely recognize
him. You think so? Brian Harman.
If he went to Athens, people would recognize him. If he went to Columbus, Ohio, no, I do not think Brian Harman would be overly recognized.
What about Harris English?
Harris English, no.
No. Chris Kirk?
Nope.
No. Why?
I'm telling you, like you could lump them all in one category. Now they've all accomplished some pretty remarkable things, whether it's Chris Kirk and his comeback, Brian Harman with his major championship, Hud Swafford with his lived disappearance. Who knows? But I think you could all lump them in at least a couple of years ago. Actually, Rex, speaking of a guy who is now inside the top 50 in the world, how about that for professional segue? How about Grayson Murray? Longtime PGA Tour player now, won in his rookie season on the PGA Tour in 2017, and yet it has been a miserable few years marked by alcohol abuse, depression, anxiety, lost his PGA Tour card, had to apprentice for a year on the Korn Ferry Tour, and yet he showed up at Sony, I think, looking and sounding like a completely different player, and he's the player after nailing down a 40-footer on the first hole of a playoff that defeated Keegan Bradley and Ben on to win his second PGA Tour event. Pretty good story, especially coming a week after what Chris Kirk did at Kapalua as well, fighting very similar demons. What do you make of the journey that Grayson Murray has been on and where he is now?
No, I thought the conversation yesterday on Golf Today was interesting, at least in my mind, because, and I think what Eamon asked me was, does the tour need to be a little bit more aware of players' mental health? Maybe do they need to do more maybe for players? And I know where Eamon was going. My take was, yes, of course the tour needs to do better by players, by caddies, by employees. I would say society in general has to do better, period, when it comes to mental health. I was taken by, and you mentioned it, coming on the heels of the Chris Kirk story. And it's they both kind of suffered. Now, granted, Grayson's was not in quiet, where Chris seemed like he kind of suffered in private. Grayson was out there in the public realm, at least on social media. I was taken by the idea that this is almost like a lifestyle thing on the PGA Tour. And I'm not trying to make excuses for players or caddies or anyone else that's on the traveling circus. But I remember talking with Scott Hamilton last week, the swing coach for Chris Kirk, and he was telling me that even through Chris's darkest days, he never realized anything was wrong. They would go out to dinner, they'd have a glass of wine or two, and then go their separate ways. And it turns out Chris would go back to his room and keep drinking. But you don't know that. I mean, and I think that's sort of the suffering in silence that just compounds those things. And I think Grayson Murray probably went through a very, very similar process, where living that kind of lifestyle where you have so much downtime and you're probably beating yourself up a lot over things either you did or did not do on the golf course, it's probably not the healthiest lifestyle, period. And now you've also factored in other things like alcoholism or substance abuse on some level. I'm actually surprised we don't have more of it. As we were getting ready yesterday for that segment, I kind of went through the last year of players who have become more and more open. Aaron Wise is one that came up. Clearly, Bubba Watson is one that talked about. Matt Wolf, of course, was a topic of conversation a lot last year. And that's just kind of, you know, scraping the outside of the shell. I think there's so much more here. But when you look at a player like Grayson Murray, and I was taken on Sunday, just like I was taken on the previous Sunday, how honest he was in answering a lot of the questions that he ended up having to answer after the victory. It's once you get to the point where you're willing to say, I have a problem, And that I am fascinated by the idea of that's the point that you're okay talking about it in public. And my guess is 3 years ago, Grayson or even Chris would have never been that comfortable sitting in front of a microphone answering those types of very, very difficult questions. I think it's a testament to not just what they were able to overcome, but how they were able to overcome it.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And I was actually struck. So I've known Grayson Murray for a very long time. He was actually one of the first golfers I ever interviewed. I started Golf Week magazine in March 2010. And at that time, Grayson was either 15 or 16, but a highly accomplished junior player in North Carolina. He was kind of in that realm, at least in that world, with Jordan Spieth, Patrick Rogers, Ollie Schneider-Jans, Justin Thomas. Like, everyone knew he was going places. And yet there was always kind of this reputation that preceded him. A little bit of a wild child, kind of bounced around. He went to, I think, three schools in three different semesters when it was time for college before he ultimately left Arizona State. And I did a long feature on him back in 2017. And at that time, he'd made some headlines with some of the things that he was saying on social media. He'd had some of these kind of anxious panic attacks on the golf course or at home. And I read that story that I wrote on Monday morning after his win. And it was incredibly haunting to hear the challenges that he was battling at that time and how it actually got worse over the past 6 years before it ultimately culminated with him spending a month in rehab and trying to get his life in order. He's now 8 months sober. Good for him. But here's a quote, Rex, from Grayson Murray's dad, Eric, who, when talking about Grayson's struggle, said, quote, "I think I'll always be concerned because no parent wants to have a physical or mental obstacle put in their kid's way. I'm concerned because I know how hard it is for him. I would love to see Grayson play golf without these issues and see how good he could have been. Oh my gosh, just unbelievable. But this is what he was dealt with, and he's dealing with it, and he's always going to be dealing with it. At the end of 20 years, I think he's going to look back and say that he's had a good career, but only he's in control of that." It is, I think, incredibly heartwarming, and it's got to be satisfying for Grayson Murray to see that he has regained control of his life and career at this point. You know, hearing him in his post-round press conference from Wiley, like, he's now 30. He's so much more mature. He is getting married in April. He's kind of rediscovered his faith. He's clearly a family man. He's always had a great relationship with his parents, but I think that's even been forged more now because of the struggles that he's had. He's not the arrogant and angry and jealous young hotshot when he first came out on the PGA Tour. He sounds and appears humbled and appreciative of what he's gone through. And obviously that's the counseling that he's received. And he has certain slogans that he's talking to himself on the golf course and the help that he's receiving outside the golf course as well. But he has the support system now, I think, at age 30, finally, to really make something of his career. Because the talent has never been in question. Like, you watch him play golf at the Sony Open, hits it a mile, really good iron player, and his short game was absolutely sick. Some of the saves that he had on 16 and 17 to stay in the mix with Keegan Bradley and Ben on. I'm very excited to see where he goes from here. It wouldn't surprise me if he made kind of like a Wyndham Clark-esque jump in 2024. Very similar games. And now with his life more centered, I think that's certainly in the range of possibilities for him.
Well, and it occurs to me that you pointed out that he's 30 years old, and eventually you'd like to think everyone grows up. That's not the case, but maturity, the game, being humbled. I mean, eventually it seems to settle in for most people at some point. And at 30 years old, I would actually tip the cap to him and say, man, like, after everything you've been through, that's pretty impressive. I guess the part that really resonated with me was when he was so honest on Sunday asking about the struggles with alcoholism. And he said the worst thing that probably could have happened to him in his entire life is that PGA Tour victory came when he was hungover for three of those four rounds. And you kind of, it allowed him to convince himself that, okay, this is normal. I can operate like this. And maybe 30 years ago on the PGA Tour, he probably could have gotten away with it for a decade or two. You and I both know plenty of players who played during that era that probably got away with it for a decade or two. You can't really do that anymore because the margins are so thin. You can't give away strokes essentially because you're staying up on a Thursday or Friday night drinking when you probably should be back in your room getting room service, getting ready for the next round. I think it's a byproduct of the modern game, and it's probably for the best when you consider that Chris Kirk realized it, Grayson Murray realized it. I would be curious how many players haven't come to that conclusion yet, because I have to believe there's players out there that are watching these examples thinking to themselves, I can learn from that.
I'm well aware that Grayson Murray is probably not the most popular player among fans. He's said and done some things that are pretty reprehensible. But for me, at least, it's great to see a player regain ownership of his life and career. And I think Grayson Murray has certainly done that. Rex, before we get to what's on the grill, because it was actually a big weekend in the Lavner household, a couple of odds and ends before we get out of here. I was struck. John Rahm's Legion 13 team on Liv, that's what he's going to be calling it, Legion 13, has not yet been finalized, even with the season starting just 3 weeks away. Some pro Liv accounts on social media rumored John Rahm to be in deep discussions with reigning U.S. Open champion Wyndham Clark and Tennessee sophomore Caleb Surratt. Thoughts on those rumors, that speculation, and that possibility?
I don't get much feedback now when it comes to teams, just because it seems like there was a frenzy right after Doral about exactly how this was going to work out. There was going to be a free agency period. So I really haven't heard much in the last few weeks. I will tell you, last Friday, I started getting calls like close to midnight saying and talking to me about Caleb, and it came from people who watch the industry and know these players much better than I do. And apparently he was on John's list early in the process when he wanted to create a team. He's exactly what he's looking for. I almost texted you. I knew at midnight on Friday night you were well asleep, well put to bed.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Because you're up at 6 a.m. So I didn't actually text you. It is interesting. He seems to have embraced this more than the other captains that I've seen, whether if that's fair or not, because we don't know exactly what's going on behind the lines. I think the Wyndham Clark stuff, and again, I hate doing this because it's just, we're just feeding the machine when we sit here and talk about it. And you're right, they're pro live accounts that are putting this stuff out there. So there's a reason why someone wants us talking about it. Whatever his team is going to look like, regardless, take the names out of it. There's going to be John Rahm, a B player, a C player, and a D player. That's the way it works out. Whoever those players are, more than likely, at least one of them is going to come from the PGA Tour, and it's going to be one more hit during a time that's going to be and only make this more awkward, because now you have people from both sides, from PIF and the PGA Tour, sitting in a room trying to have serious conversations about serious things. And now you're going to throw this on the side. I think it's only going to make it more difficult.
Yeah. And Wyndham Clark makes sense for Liv kind of in the same way that John Rahm made sense for Liv. He's in the prime of his career. He won a signature event last year. He won a major championship. He's 29, 30 years old. He's in all the majors for at least the next 5 years. And if now he can get a guaranteed payday with the future looking increasingly murky, or at least the potential is there for all sides to be joined together in a year or two, why not make the jump if you're Wyndham Clark? I would be more struck by Caleb Surratt. He's a sophomore at Tennessee. He just played on the U.S. Walker Cup team, had a phenomenal freshman season for the Volunteers. The connection with John Rahm here is they're both Callaway staffers, and Caleb Surratt was the number one ranked amateur in the world last year. He would obviously be a target for Liv Golf, for the PIF, if you're trying to shore up kind of the future pipeline. This was always, I think, the concern if you were the PGA Tour. When Liv first launched in 2022, the thinking and what actually happened was they looked at the world rankings, they looked at the golf stat rankings at the time, and they just went down the list and tried to single out who could we attack, because you could get the Lee Westwoods and the Ian Poulters and Sergio Garcias of the world, players who want one last payday when the competitive prospects are dimming. But to be able to snag a Eugenio Chikara, a David Puge, both who were highly accomplished college players, and get them into the live cycle early, that was where they were going to make the most headway. It wouldn't necessarily be in year one or year two, but if Liv and the PIF were thinking long-term for the next 5 or 10 years, getting those players in the pipeline, getting them in the system is where they wanted to go. That's why I'd be so struck by the Caleb Surratt signing, if that does come to fruition. He's just 19 or 20 years old as well, with a very promising college career ahead of him. Rex, hat tip to your friend and mine, Russ. Hertz is selling off its remaining fleet of electric vehicles. If you're wondering why the hell we would possibly be talking about this on the Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav, you had a forgettable experience with
last year this week,
a Tesla. You nearly missed your red eye flight. How encouraged are you to see that the official provider for NBC Universal in Hertz is selling off the rest of its EVs?
I think, and we had to be perfectly clear about this. Neither one of us have anything against EVs. Like, certainly if I commuted to a job that was 2 miles away and I could plug it into my garage every night, yep, that's perfect. Like, that's exactly what I would be looking for. What I ran into is, if you've never experienced one of these, if you've never driven a Tesla, then you don't have any idea how it works. And so I'm just going to make this quick. When I got in the car in Los Angeles, and I was going from Los Angeles to Palm Springs for this week's American Express, and I suddenly was just overwhelmed with panic because I don't know how it works. Like, when you get in a car, you can see, oh, I got a full tank of gas, I should be good to go. I had no idea. So it took a long time for me to actually figure out, okay, it tells you exactly how far you have. It gives you charging stations along the way. Cool, cool, cool. That works out well. As I discovered throughout the course of the week, if it's colder, it takes longer to charge. So instead of sitting in that parking lot in the mall next to my hotel in Palm Springs for 20 minutes, I got to sit there now for 40 minutes. And that doesn't even get me to LAX for my red eye flight, as you pointed out. I almost missed it. It's a ridiculous car to get for a rental car if you're not driving a finite amount of time. Sure, if you're picking it up at the airport and you're driving it to the airport Marriott and then back to the airport, fine. You don't have to worry about it. If you're going any amount of distance, you know what? I'm wrong. I did get worked up over something. Thank you very much.
You would rent a car for convenience, and having an electric vehicle, which would require a 20 to 30 minute charge to get back to full strength, is the opposite of convenience. That's exactly what you do not want. No. If you are a Hertz customer, good for you. We will continue to rent from you and accumulate points.
Not sure we had a choice in that matter, but thank you nonetheless.
Forward. And speaking of Palm Springs, I used to cover this event. You were not covering this event this week either, Rex, but we do have a comeback of sorts with Daniel Berger playing his first PGA Tour event in a year and a half. A lot of rumors, a lot of speculation. He was supposed to relaunch his career last summer, then last fall, and now he is finally doing so with the third event of 2024. When Daniel Berger last teed up, Rex, at the U.S. Open in 2022, he was ranked 25th in the world, primetime player. He played in the Ryder Cup in fall 2021. You happy to see him? You happy to see Boog back?
I am happy to see Boog back, because when he's healthy, he is among those top 10, top 15 players in the world. And he certainly goes to where we are in the game right now. Like, trust me, the PGA Tour needs all the stars they can possibly get. And if somehow Daniel can come back and play somehow, some even close to what he was before he left, I'm always curious. Like, these could be devastating injuries that he's had to go through. And it has lingered, as you pointed out. Like, we'd heard rumors he was coming back late last year and then into the fall, and then it was pretty much on hold until now. Now, that might just be by design, just to sort of set up exactly how he wants his medical to play out. That's nothing new for the way players work this out. But certainly in the case of Daniel, and we've had this conversation about other players before, so young, so talented. He was part of that high school class of, I'm going to get it wrong, 2011?
Got it.
Nailed. Did I nail it?
Look at you.
Part of that 2011 class, so much talent, as much talent as anyone else in that class. You really would like to think he can come back and overcome all of those injuries.
Yeah, I'm with you. And they've been very serious back injuries to the point where he was kind of bedridden for 3 to 6 months, really dealing with a lot of pain and discomfort. I'm happy to see Boog back. A lot of swagger. He's definitely got some DJAF in him. I love to see Boog back and hope he returns to form quickly. Rex, it was a big week on the grill for yours truly. We'll get to that in a second. But for the wild card playoff round, which actually extended 3 days, plus the Sony Open, what'd you fire up on the grill?
It was a meat-driven Sunday. And I told my kids this. My wife was out of town, so it was just me and the boys. And so I made the arrangements that it was going to be sun up to sundown. It was going to be nothing but I smoked a pork butt. I did chicken wings, and I did ribs for the matinee. at night. So I was out there all day long because it was the, for me, that was pretty much going to be the last. Well, it is the last football weekend. Like I go, I leave on Sunday to go up to Connecticut. Don't get back. I guess I'll be around for the conference championships. Yeah.
Yeah. Conference championships is Sunday of Tory week. That's why Tory Pines is ending on that Saturday to basically clear away for the NFL conference championships on that Sunday. Although you'd probably be leaving first thing that Monday morning to get to Pebble for the signature.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah, you're right. So this was going to be it. So we went out with a bang. It was pretty good. What'd you fire up?
So this was a big weekend for yours truly as well. I want to preface this by saying this may actually be the last What's on the Grill segment, or at least the last What's on the Grill segment, which we could actually do some pretty serious grilling and not just with like some portobello mushrooms. I do have a biometric screening scheduled for Thursday. Have not had blood work done in about 3 years' time. And so if that comes back how it did 6 or 7 years ago, with basically indicating that I'm on death's door, there may need to be some lifestyle changes that are implemented. But until then, definitely feels like we're cramming for this test. I got some pill I'm supposed to be taking for the next couple of days, hoping it flushes all those fatty acids out of my body. But I've always wanted to do hibachi on the Blackstone, but I'm a little bit scared. I didn't necessarily like all of the prep work and the knife work that was going to go into it. And look, doing hibachi on the Blackstone is a lot of work. It's a lot of ingredients. It's a lot of cutting. It's a lot of chopping. It's a lot of crying with all the onions that you have to do. But I have to say, it was absolutely worth it. It was delicious. We did beef and chicken hibachi, threw some mushrooms in there, threw some onion, threw some peppers, did the whole fried rice thing. Was it a lot of work? Yes. Do I want to do it every week or every month? Probably not. Again, a lot of work. But my wife loved it. So it's one of the best things that I've ever cooked. So I will do it again, but probably not for a little bit of time. On Sunday, we had some bad weather on Saturday. On Sunday, Rex, I fired up the workhorse offset and I smoked some chicken wings. But I didn't just smoke chicken wings, pull them off the smoker, and then eat them right away. I smoked them to about 175, which took 45 minutes to an hour. So I got them exactly where I wanted to, pulled them off in a pan, and then for Christmas, my beautiful wife, Amy, got me a little countertop fryer. I didn't want that whole like Bayou classic thing that just, it takes up space, requires so much oil, is super messy. So this is like basically a countertop fryer, and you can throw probably 12 to 14 wings in there at a time, or you can fry anything you want to. I was just happening to do wings at this time. And I fried them for 5 to 7 minutes, pulled them off, and then doused them, obviously, in buffalo sauce. They were outstanding because you didn't just get the smoke flavor from the offset and burning real wood, but then you get that crispy skin that everyone is after and encoded in the buffalo sauce that's so familiar if you go to any sort of wing joint. And so I thought it was very fitting that on Sunday and then on Monday for the resumption of the Bills Steelers game in Buffalo that I was having buffalo wings. They were absolutely delicious. If anyone is curious about this countertop fryer, I would be more than happy to send you a link. I know you were curious as well. Cannot recommend it enough. It was like $115, not overly expensive, easy cleanup. Cannot recommend it enough. But that is the way if we're cooking for a party and you don't just want to get them done in 30 to 45 minutes, that's the way we're going to be doing it moving forward.
Two things. One, it is some prep work to get ready for hibachi, but it's not a difficult, like you're not lifting anything. Like you're just cutting up onions and mushrooms, and we do zucchini, and then you just pre-make the rice.
I've got Lily clinging to my leg. I've got to get Cam 7 different snacks while he's watching his iPad. Meanwhile, I'm trying to slice and dice onions as finely as possible. It's just,
well, they shouldn't be fine. That's the point.
That was not my definition of fun.
I will do that if not once, and I won't do it once a week, but definitely once a month. That's not the problem. And I'm with you. We actually, when I did wings, I believe it was on Sunday, I smoked them. I did mine to like 165, and then I just kind of flash fried them really quick just to get sort of that sort of crisp on the outside. But before I did that, I tossed them in the hot wing sauce, and then you put them in the fryer. Perfect.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't do any sort of breading. I think that's what I'll try next time, is to do the breading if you want to. There's definitely a window that you need to pull the wings off the grill. I think it's between that 160 to 180. You want to make sure they're fully cooked, that they're edible, but you don't want to leave them so long in the fryer or on the smoker that they then become overcooked and they get dry. Like you can push wings to 190, 200, but if you're pulling your wings off at 180 and then you're frying them for 5 to 7 minutes, they're going to be a little bit dry. So there's definitely...
Oh, and I didn't like fry them. I fried them for not even a full minute. I just wanted to sort of flash fry them to get some sort of crisp on the outside. That's it.
How high were you using the oil?
The oil was really hot. I don't have the fancy thing that you sent me that your lovely wife Amy bought you. But what I have is I do have like a stove that's attached to one of my grills, and so it's just off straight off the propane, and that thing just gets raging hot. So I have to work hard to keep it sort of not as hot.
just overflowing. Toes are melting when the vegetable oil is spilling over.
And it's just a little tiny, like I have a full size, like frying fryer that it's what I do meatballs in it. I do everything in it. And so, but it's just a little bit of oil down at the bottom, but it gets so hot. I literally have to turn the heat source off in between just to get it to cool down a little bit and then fire it back up.
It sounds like a public safety hazard, but that's an issue probably another day. Bunk, if you're listening, Rex would dearly love this countertop fryer. Valentine's Day, as we know, is right around the corner. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Thank you guys, as always, for listening to this edition. We'll be back next week for a full recap of the American Express, the first event back at the PGA Tour and the United States mainland, as well as a recap of the divisional round of the NFL playoffs. I have not yet explored what we'll be doing on the grill, but stay tuned. I'll give you guys all the deets on that. Hope you guys have a great rest of the week. Make sure you check out Rex on Golf Central on Tuesday. He's the guest analyst, and yours truly. Yes, they're that desperate that I will be doing it on Wednesday. Should be a lot of fun. Talk to you guys next week.
Appreciate you, James.